afternoon. The United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit is now in session.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
Good afternoon. This is the time for hearing the appeal in Ross versus Davis. And I understand, counsel, you have split your time and asked for time in rebuttal. So the clock will show 10 minutes for each of you. Is Mr. James or is Mr. Newton going first?
I am, Your Honor, Norman James.
Right, counsel, you may proceed.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. As the court knows, the central issue in this case is ineffective assistance of counsel, mentally phased.
Right, counsel, we're going to have to stop for a minute because I can't hear you at all. Excuse me, one second.
There's some noise going on in the back, too. It sounds like they're doing
Doesn't happen in the courtroom.
No, I'm in my conference room with the windows open and there's a truck. So we're going to be closing the windows. So if you just bear with us for a minute. Still loud. Okay. All right, counsel, you may proceed now.
All right. As the court knows, this central issue here is ineffective counsel mentally phased prejudice on claim one. Claim two, which Mr. Newton's going to address, is the end of claim. We are contending in a bit of an unusual situation that the California Supreme Court's decision in this case was clearly contrary to the established law in the test they use to determine prejudice, deferring the performance standards.
Basically, you're not questioning anything
We are, Your Honor. Although I admit there was a disagreement, I think, between the Attorney General and us in terms of whether or not this court would decide the performance prong de novo if you decided the contrary to clause applied as to the prejudice prong. I think that Judge Wilson said that you wouldn't need to do that. The Attorney General thinks you would, and I think we said that you wouldn't have to, but probably looking at it now, that it would be a requirement of a de novo determination by this court on performance if, in fact, you determine that the prejudice also has to be de novo. Does that not answer
the question? So at the penalty phase, I mean, basically, I don't know if his name is Mr. Lenoir, or I don't know how to say it, but Lenoir. Anyway, he didn't interview any witnesses or anything like that, but there was like three sort of stipulated pieces of evidence that came in, and that your client was like 21 years old, and then there were some things that came in that had to do with one of the other defendants that was tried separately. That was kind of surprising to me. I would never have agreed to that coming in as a prosecutor. And I think as a judge, I would have never let that in. I mean, essentially, it seemed that the defense was trying to say, well, this other defendant got LWOP, or, you know, didn't get the death penalty. And then also that the finding in terms of trying to argue that your client was not the shooter, as it were, and so therefore arguing for lesser. I mean, if those had worked, that would be pretty good. That could have worked out pretty well for your client. And I'm just, did the prosecutor just agree to that, or did you, I mean, I never would have sat down for that, and I wouldn't have let it in for a judge. I think there's, you don't, you know, generally let what comes, what happened to other people.
I think that was a comparative a sentence issue or argument that isn't allowable. And I think the California Supreme Court, if I remember, addressed that in the fact that had it been objected to, it would certainly have not been allowed.
It's a good argument when you got a young guy and then someone else didn't hear, they're trying to get death on him, and then one of the Codys didn't get it. So.
Well,
counsel, was there any actual evidence admitted that was mitigating evidence, or is this more like a case like Andrews v. Davis?
This is like Andrews v. Davis. I don't think there's any question. The Supreme Court of California itself said that there was no evidence presented at the penalty phase. In fact, no evidence presented by Lenoir at the guilt phase. None. There were three things. One is a stipulation to Ross's age at 21. And number two, a stipulation that the court could take judicial notice of Malik's sentence, the shooter, as it were. And I think the other one was a stipulation to the fact that, his name escapes me right now, another person that was assaulted by Ross when he was a juvenile had been, and Ross had been convicted of that. And I think it was a stipulation concerning the fact that he had been a member of a gang, or whatever that's worth. I mean, these, obviously, from the evidence, even in the guilt phase, these were all gang sort of members. But that was all. There was not one shred of evidence of any kind. No witnesses, no stipulations, no nothing concerning what we're talking about here mostly. That is the defendant's social background. His actual family or education or social background. There was no evidence of any kind presented. And that is like Andrews v. Davis. It's like some other cases. I've listed some in the brief that were decided.
The facts of the case are always considered part of the evidence on the aggravation, but that's not the mitigation, right?
No, that's right. And it certainly doesn't. I think the main thing, Your Honor, is what we're talking about in mitigation here is the social background, the family history. And none of that was.
But don't you mean specifically the child abuse that he suffered?
Yes.
And isn't that a long, well-established basis of mitigating evidence that the U.S. Supreme Court recognizes?
It has, absolutely, Your Honor. And Wiggins, for one thing, I think it's important to note here that the Supreme Court of California itself acknowledged that the mitigating evidence of Ross's family history was very important and was material. And of course, they just ruled that it would, for other reasons, it was not prejudicial. But I thought it was interesting that in the later case that I cited in the brief, In re Lucas, which was a California Supreme Court case, in that case, I've got it, they actually discussed our case here in that case some years later and state with respect to this that the mitigation in Ross, this mitigating evidence was weighty, particularly the evidence of the rejection and extraordinary abuse petitioner suffered at the hands of his family when he was a young child. Such evidence may be the basis for a jury's determination that a defendant's relative moral culpability is less than would be suggested solely by reliance upon the crime of which he stands convicted and other aggravating evidence. That was the Supreme Court's own interpretation of this case sometime later in Lucas, in which they did find prejudice.
Well, but let me ask you this. I mean, are you arguing the proponent that if you don't attorney's failure to present mitigating evidence is categorically prejudicial, or is there a second analysis under prejudice?
Well,
it's sort of like, is it per se, or is...
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. I don't think the cases hold that it's per se automatic. Keep in mind that when there has to be some cases, there are, where a defense attorney actually does have a reasoned judgment as to why not to put on mitigation. A lot of it depends on what that mitigation may be, but the failure to do it when it hasn't been investigated, when the defense attorney doesn't know what it is, I think, pretty much automatic deficient counsel.
Well, okay, but I'm more at that, but you still have to do the prejudice prong. Let's say I agree with you. Okay, he was wrong. Let's say that, but that doesn't equal prejudice. The prejudice prong is separate, correct? Are you saying categorically, if he didn't do it, therefore that satisfies the second prong and it's reversed? That's not the way I read the law.
No, I don't read it that way either, but if you're talking about whether you're deciding it de novo, it wouldn't be automatic, but of course the court would give consideration to the actual test that should be employed.
Counsel, to be specific on prejudice, one of the factors the Supreme Court relied upon in deciding that it was not prejudicial was the available impeachment and rebuttal evidence. Now, can you go through that evidence and tell me why you don't think that was a solid basis for the Supreme Court's decision?
Well, I can shortcut that by saying that I agree totally with Judge Kennard in the Supreme Court's dissent, and she discussed it at length. And as she pointed out, they talked about impeachment, which was the statement of the mother at a time that controverted what she said later about how he had behaved. And another was the statement that he had made to a probation officer when he was 15 and he wanted to go home, in which he denied there had been any abuse. That was the impeachment, which I agree with Justice Kennard that it was not very weak. The other thing would be the juvenile findings, which were four when he was in juvenile, four, I think, robbery petitions, and the most serious one being when he threatened a cook with a knife.
With a fork, a cooking fork.
Cooking fork. And again, that is not an overwhelmingly rich impeachment or rebuttal.
Well, the jury would take that into consideration, but what the Supreme Court said is that it would have... I guess the question is whether the Supreme Court was reasonable in assuming that evidence would compel a finding of no prejudice by the jury.
May I address quickly, Your Honor, that? And that is what I call the all or nothing thing. And that is, the Supreme Court in this case discussed it as if there was no choice. The counsel either put in all of those 15 people to talk about not only his bad abuses as a child, but also the good things about how he was a good guy with his sister and so forth. And that's not the case. A competent attorney would be able to know, and the Supreme Court of California acknowledged that all of that evidence would not be allowed to rebut evidence.
It would depend on what mitigating evidence the counsel had put in, right?
I would pick out several of the witnesses of those 15 that he wouldn't put on to testify he was a good brother, he was a good son, this and that. But just the evidence of child abuse would not allow much of that impeachment or much of the evidence that they're claiming would be rebuttal. So that would be a choice a competent attorney would make.
So we have to make a determination, though, that the California Supreme Court's conclusion was unreasonable. And I'm trying to figure out especially in light of the Woodford versus Biscotti case, how you would say that we would accomplish that?
Well, you wouldn't have to make that a conclusion, Your Honor, if you agreed with what we're arguing, and that is that...
Let's say for purposes of this question that we don't agree with you on the contrary, that we're looking at this based on the unreasonable application of Strickland, and we're under AEDPA review. I guess I want to know what's your best case, especially in light of Woodford versus Biscotti.
Well, the most recent case in the circuit, a discussion, I think that was the one that was just, I mentioned earlier, sorry. Andrews?
Avena?
No.
Yes.
The Biscotti case, I don't really think is applicable because...
Tell me why.
Well, there were two, it was a complex thing there where there were two separate claims of ineffective assistance in the penalty phase. One was the closing argument, which he conceded most of the aggravating factors that are in the code. That was the argument. That was separate from the failure to investigate and present mitigation. And those were the Supreme Court's decision on that, avoided and didn't even discuss the argument one, and instead determined that the prejudice, it was prejudicial for the mitigation and didn't outweigh the aggravation. But I thought Biscotti was confusing because the circuit decision on that conflates the two. It talks about the closing argument and the mitigation, and those two were separate claims, as I see.
Judge Warlock, may I ask one other question?
Of course.
Mr. James, I wanted to ask you, what investigation was done on Mr. Ross on his mental health throughout the case? There's some reference in the district court's 2005 order denying your motion for an evidentiary hearing to Dr. Myers, referring to Mr. Ross as an apparently retarded individual. Yes. But beyond that, it doesn't seem to me that we have much on Mr. Ross's mental health. Whatever happened with that, or what's...
Well, there wasn't an adequate effort made to obtain an expert to put on at the reference hearings what happened. And the judge, Judge Steinen, disallowed it, that it was not appropriate because it had not been brought up, I think, at the trial stage. And we brought a motion to permit that before Judge Wilson. He denied it.
To permit what?
To have our own expert. The expert that the previous attorneys in this case found an expert who would have found what you're discussing in terms of mental health, and wanted to put that expert on, but Judge Tynan would not allow it. Said it was beyond the scope of the reference hearing, and Judge Wilson agreed, and so we were unable to do that. I doubt after Penholster it would have been admissible anyway.
Judge Wardlaw, may I ask a question without cutting into Mr. Newton's time?
Yes, Mr. Newton will have his 10 minutes. I'm go ahead, please.
Thank you. Mr. James, this is a factual question. It was in the record, did it tell us anywhere the 14-year-old disabled child that was executed in, do we know what his disability was?
I think it was a learning disability. It wasn't a learning disability, as I understand it, remember it, so that he, it wasn't, I don't think like he was physically disabled. He had a learning disability. And so he went to school, but only half time, and his dad came and picked him up.
So if the argument was that he killed him to eliminate a witness, I guess by the time we get to the last robbery, though, your client rapes the sister twice and then kills the the alleged drug dealer and victim executes that person in front of the mother. So it doesn't seem that they decided they needed to get rid of all the witnesses at that point.
Well, Your Honor, there was no evidence that Ross, who was convicted on a felony murder basis, there's no evidence that he was the shooter in either of those cases. None. And in fact, that's acknowledged in the Supreme Court of California's case.
He wasn't charged with being the shooter, was he?
Well, I don't, there was an assertion that a statement he made in the Taylor case that I'm the one that calls the shots, but he was in charge of both of these. But in the Hassan case, there's only fingerprint evidence that he was even there. But there is no evidence that he was the shooter. And may I, now that you raised it, I think it's an interesting point. In the Hassan case, there was a tape recording of a conversation that Ross had with Champion, which was put in by the government as for establishing that he participated. But in the conversation was the fact that Ross asked Champion the question, was that a waterbed in the room? And he asked Champion, and Champion said, uh-huh. And that suggests, at least you can infer from that, that Ross wasn't the one who was in that bedroom and shot Michael and Eric on that bed. He was asking about it. It's a minor point, but it does suggest that. But in any event, with respect to whether he even killed Michael Taylor, there's no evidence of that. And Your Honor, Judge Kellen, I may ask, or may say that in that case, do not forget that Mallett came into that with the gun. He's the only one who was ever seen with a gun there in the Taylor case. And he's also the one that told Mary, either you do what we say and get the drugs and this and that, or I will kill all of you, starting with you. That was Mallett, not Ross. So none of it is...
Your client raped her twice.
Yes, no question about that. He left his fingerprint on the bathtub. But in terms of, if we're talking about heinous offenses, in terms of that offsetting mitigation, there are a whole lot more heinous offenses than this, of which I know the court's aware, in terms of balancing the aggravating or mitigating evidence against the nature of the crime.
All right, why don't we let Mr. Newton have his 10 minutes now? Your mic, you're not muted. I mean, you're muted.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you now.
Okay. If I could segue back to the last question, in terms of the murder of Michael Taylor, the three people entered the Taylor apartment, our client Ross, an individual by the name of Jerome Evan Meyer, Mallett, and the third person, who's only identified as a tall guy. The Taylor family stated that, and it's, you can find this in volume 10 of the reporter's transcript, pages 2146 to 47. It was Mallett who said, if you don't get me the drugs or the money, I will kill each of you. Ross went into the bathroom and raped Mary Taylor. And then Mallett came into the bathroom and Ross said, we have to get out of here. Ross and Mallett left the bathroom, leaving in the bathroom Mary Taylor, her mother Cora, and a friend. Then there's a shot heard. Now, no one knows who shot Michael Taylor. There's no evidence who the shooter was, although there's strong evidence, or at least certainly an inference, given the fact that it was Mallett and only Mallett who had a weapon. But I think also importantly, before Ross went to trial, the district attorney's office in Los Angeles charged Mallett as a principal in the murder of Michael Taylor. he was tried in Long Beach, and he was convicted of being a principal in the murder of Michael Taylor, and in doing so, using a firearm. Ross was charged, along with his co-defendant Steve Champion, with respect to the Michael Taylor murder, as being an aider and abettor. He was not charged as the shooter in the Ross trial.
And Mallett's sentence?
Mallett's sentence was 46 years to life, because while he was found guilty as a principal for killing Michael Taylor, and found that was enhanced by having possession of a gun, the jury hung, according to the prosecutor in Ross's case. The jury hung because they couldn't agree on the special allegation of robbery or burglary, and that's that can be found in volume 15 of the reporter's transcript at page 3516.
So they hung on the special circumstance.
They hung on the special circumstance, which took away the death penalty, so he was sentenced to 46 to life.
Okay, but on your client, as to your Edmund versus Florida claim, didn't the jury necessarily find that Ross possessed the requisite intent to kill when it convicted him of the special circumstance, given that the jury instruction, but given jury instruction is for that charge?
Respectfully, no. I know that's what the California Supreme Court said, but if you look at the actual jury instruction, it's 8.80, Caldrick 8.80. That instruction, according to the California Supreme Court, by finding that allegation to be true, the court said it necessarily shared that it proved that it was that Ross necessarily shared the intent of the shooter or the killer. Now, the problem with that is if you look at the jury instruction itself, it says if the defendant is not the actual killer, it must be proved beyond a reasonable doubt that he aided the actual killer in the commission of the murder. But that could be the same thing that happened to poor Mr. Edmund, who was driving a car. Two guys get out of the back seat of the car, go around to the back of the house and shoot an elderly couple. He aided the commission of the murder. But Edmund is all about one thing. Death is different. You have to have the specific intent to kill, attempt to kill, or intend, or actually intend to kill. And Tyson said that the intent to kill element would be met by major participation and reckless disregard for life. But
was Edmund decided at the time that the California Supreme Court reason that way on the direct appeal?
Edmund was decided in July of 1982. The Supreme Court decision in this case came down in 1995.
So they had they don't cite to Edmund.
They don't cite to Edmund. They don't cite to the fact that this is that Edmund applies in Eighth Amendment cases because death is different. They don't cite to the specific intent of Ross or of Ross with respect to either the Hassan or the Taylor murders. And quite frankly, under the Cabana case that I cited in our supplemental brief, the Supreme Court says that if in fact there's not a specific finding that the defendant had the intent to kill, attempted to kill, or intended to kill, that this case has to go back to the state court for that finding to be made.
Well, the special circumstance instruction says if defendant was not the actual killer, must be proved beyond a reasonable doubt that he intentionally aided, abetted, counseled, commanded, induced, solicited, requested, or assisted the actual killer in the commission of the murder in the first degree before you are permitted to find of that first degree murder to be true as the defendant. Is that correct?
That is correct. And what's missing from that instruction is any reference to the aider and abettor's intent under felony murder. It simply says if he aided or assisted the commission of a murder. Respectfully, I would suggest that if I drove, like Mr. Edmund did, if I drove somebody to a house knowing that they intended to rob him, and in the process they killed him, I would have aided the commission of the murder. But what I'm missing is the intent that that Edmund says you have to have if you're going to execute somebody under a felony, under a felony murder rule, who is not the actual killer.
Mr. Newton, it looks like the jury instruction, considering the special circumstance, says, you know, and I'm trying to figure out why is it enough that the jury made the special circumstance finding that Ross and its, quote, intentionally aided, abetted, counseled, commanded, induced, solicited, requested, or assisted the actual killer in the commission of the murder in the first degree. Why isn't that enough under the Edmund Tyson rule, especially in light of our Tapia ruling?
Because it has, it simply says if the aider and abettor performs any act that assists the killer in the commission of first degree murder, then he's guilty of first degree murder. Whereas Edmund says, no, you've got to also show the intent of the aider and abettor in a felony murder case.
What should the instruction have said in your view?
It would have had to have said if he aided and abetted with the intent to kill, attempted to kill, or intended a murder to take place. That's what Edmund says. That's the intent that should have been put into that instruction. Instruction
with the word aiding. Doesn't Tapia say that the jury's separate determination that Tapia was guilty of special circumstances related to both murders when it shows that necessarily determined that Tapia had or shared the specific intent to kill both of the victims? Wasn't that evidence present here?
Respectfully, no. And I would also point out, again, death is different. Edmund and Tyson are cases where the question is, what has to be the intent of an aider and abettor before we can convict him of first degree murder? It has to be more than just he assisted in some way for the other person to kill the person.
So
Tapia also was not a death case. And our position here is based upon the fact that since the death penalty was sought and imposed, you have to conform to Edmund.
Right, but the Supreme Court of California said that is, in finding the special circumstance allegation to be true, the jury necessarily determined that the defendant shared the killer's intent when he aided and abetted the commission of the murder. So why is that sentence incorrect?
Because it doesn't discuss what intent you're talking about. Is it an intent to assist the perpetrator of the crime in some form or fashion, or is an intent to assist the perpetrator and share the same intent that there be a homicide take place? You know, if you read that instruction, it is completely silent on the question of the aider and abettor's intent. And you know, by definition, in most felony murder cases, the aider and abettor is not the one who pulls the trigger. And the Supreme Court recognized that in the Edmund case and said, we can't allow somebody to be executed simply because they aided and abetted somebody else's committed a crime unless that same aider and abettor has the same intent.
But even under Tyson, I mean, because in Tyson, we said a major, or the Supreme Court has said, you know, major participation in the felony committed combined with reckless indifference to human life is sufficient to satisfy the Edmund culpability requirement for when the death penalty may be imposed. So what's your response to that?
the Evan decision said, you, in looking at the aider and abettor, and to elevate that person to the person who actually pulls the trigger, you have to have three things. Evidence beyond a reasonable doubt of three things. One, the aider and abettor was the killer. Two, the aider and abettor attempted to kill. Or three, the aider and abettor intended that a murder take place. Now, Tyson is simply defining what that third element is. But in this case, the jury was not instructed to any of that. It was simply told that if Ross intentionally aided this other person commit first degree murder, this California Supreme Court says, if you find that true, then you have found Ross to be guilty under the felony murder rule. But Edmund said, no, you can't find him guilty under the Edmund rule unless you find, in addition to the fact that he's intending to assist, the best example really is Edmund. The driver, Edmund, drove the car to the house where two other people got out of the car, went to the back door and killed him. He didn't have any way of knowing that was going to take place, but certainly he assisted.
You've muted yourself again.
You pushed a mute button.
Okay, better?
Yes.
Okay, I would just emphasize that again, this instruction, which is Calgic 8.80, simply says, if Ross assisted the killer in carrying out the act, then according to the California Supreme Court, Ross necessarily had the same intent. But Edmund says, no, you prove it. Find that intent, which is why we're saying that since it's not in the record, there's no finding anywhere, that this case has to go back under Cabana to the state court for them to determine whether that finding had ever been made.
Let me ask you one quick question. I apparently wrote a book while he was incarcerated. This book, which is admittedly outside the record, does it have anything to do with this appeal?
I'm sorry, I couldn't follow.
Your client wrote a book while he was incarcerated, I guess. It's admittedly outside the record. Does it have anything to do with this appeal?
I don't think it had to do, I'm unaware of it, and I should be aware of it if it had anything to do with this appeal. I know he's been a prolific writer. He's written.
And Mr. Champion wrote a book. I didn't read it, but I wanted to ask you.
I don't really know what Mr. Champion did. He was a co-defendant in the trial, obviously, but I have had no
contact. They wrote it together, I think.
I am not familiar with the book.
Okay,
I'm sorry.
That answers my question. I won't read it for now.
I have a couple more questions related to Edmund. So as I understand what the California Supreme Court did was it said these are erroneous instructions on specific intent, the 2, 3.01 and 03. They were erroneous. They cited a case, their own case, that said this is erroneous, but we're going to find that the jury made this finding anyway because of this special circumstance instruction. Is that the instruction you're referring to when you talk about aiding and abetting liability?
Right.
Or is that a different one that they're relying on?
No, that's the instruction. It's instruction number 8.80. It's the special circumstance instruction. That's what was given to the jury. And as I have said, all that instruction says is if the defendant is not the actual killer, if he aided the killer, then you find a special.
But he had to have the had to have the specific intent to kill when he aided.
Right.
So he had to share the same specific intent. And the California Supreme Court says that too. It's just they make a leap. But anyway, that being said, suppose we agree with you on that claim. We agree with you. Practically, does Ross have to be completely retried?
No. What Cabana says is if there was no evidence of the intent, or if in Cabana,
there was no finding.
Right. Cabana says that if there has not been a finding of the aider and abettor being the killer or having attempted to kill or intended to kill, as in part defined by the Tyson case, it has to go back to the state court, because as a matter of comedy, the federal courts should not make that determination. It goes back to the state court and they can make a determination if the record at trial and in the court of appeals contains that finding, then they can bring it back to the federal court and basically the case is over. But the court made a very specific point in that it should not be a circuit court of appeal making that decision. It should come from the state court. So what we have suggested is, since that jury instruction 8.80 does not have anything to do with what was in the mind of Ross, did he kill and intend to kill, attempt to kill? Since there's that jury instruction is silent, it simply says if he aids somebody else, that question has to go back to the state court. If the state court then enters a finding saying yes, the evidence in the state court proceedings evidenced an intent to kill a la what are the requirements of Edmund, then that would be the end of it. You would come back to this court and you could affirm.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Why don't we hear from the warden, Mr. Mercer?
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the court, Stephen Mercer for the respondent. I'll take the claims in the order that they were discussed, if that's okay with the court. Your Honors touched on the real essence here, and that is the reasonableness of the California Supreme Court adjudication. And I'd submit to you that he is not entitled to federal relief on that claim, because the state court adjudication was not contrary to nor an unreasonable application of the clearly established Strickland test. And that reasoning and that adjudication was patently reasonable for at least three reasons that I'd like to highlight. First, that adjudication came only after extensive fact-finding through the reference hearing, an evidentiary hearing that lasted 2 months and called 32 witnesses. And then, in a published analysis spanning 40 pages, the court, citing and following Strickland, carefully considered how the penalty phase would have proceeded. A defense attorney left no stone unturned and had presented every shred of available evidence in mitigation. The court didn't blindly accept the facts from either party. They independently reviewed.
Did you say defense attorney left no stone unturned? Is that what you just said?
That the California Supreme Court, over its lengthy Strickland analysis, they considered how the penalty phase would have proceeded.
Oh, I see.
Had the defense attorney done everything that my friends on the other side of the aisle say that the attorney should have done. And they independently reviewed the whole.
Pause you just because I'm trying to, this is more for background for me.
Certainly. But
what do you know what happened to any mental evaluation? I just try to figure that out, because you're saying that, you know, we'll take at this point that they did do everything, that the Supreme Court did take into account that the counsel could have done everything they could. There's a reference that's a little troubling to me about, based on the Dr. Myers report, that says, that refers to the Ross as a mentally retarded individual. Do you know anything more about that?
I do not, Your Honor, and I'm not aware of anything in the state court record, and certainly not in the California Supreme Court decision that establishes that Ross had any mental disabilities. I'm not aware of any mental health history.
But the counsel didn't conduct any investigation as to whether or not he had mental disability. And my understanding is that if the referee didn't allow that evidence in because it wasn't within the scope of the six questions that the California Supreme Court asked the referee to make findings on. Do you agree with that much?
I agree with that, Your Honor.
All right.
So I would say that the state's ultimate conclusion here is that the verdict would have been the same even in light of the mitigating evidence from the reference hearing. And I would submit that that is a reasonable decision and hardly surprising because of Ross's both his criminal history and the fact that he committed the most serious and heinous crimes possible under California law. He participated in 3 cold-blooded murders carried out in 2 separate planned home invasion robberies. This included the murder of a disabled child who, by the way, I believe was in a wheelchair, that either found in a wheelchair or the wheelchair was his and in the house. So it was a physical disability. And Ross personally raped the sister of a 3rd murder victim twice. Given the overwhelming aggravating factors, there's no reasonable probability that...
Well, let me ask you this.
He's frozen.
Oh, I'm frozen?
No, he's frozen.
Oh,
there he's back.
Okay. Let me ask you this. You argue that Andrews v. Davis is very similar to this case, but we reversed Andrews en banc after you filed your brief. How should that case impact our analysis now?
Well, I would submit that the case is actually, there's less mitigating evidence in Ross's case by far than there was in Andrews. Let's recall that in Andrews, there was continuous physical and sexual abuse at what was called a slave camp for children, where Andrews had endured extreme ongoing physical and psychological abuse. I would also point out that in Andrews, there was actual evidence of brain damage, of PTSD, and that Andrews suffered extreme trauma and abuse. There is none of that here. We have a father who is physically abusive when he got drunk and went to the track. I'm not disputing or downplaying that he was physically abused by his stepfather. He was hit with a belt several times. I would point out that so are all of his 5 siblings, who all grew up to be productive members of society and not murdering rapists. So the abuse in Ross's case pales in comparison to the extreme sexual and physical abuse endured at a slave camp for children, which was the Andrews case. I would also note
the Supreme Court wrote that in assessing prejudice, it must also consider what counsel did do at trial. What are we to make of that? Did the court conflate the Strickland prongs, as Ross argues?
No, Your Honor, they did not. First off, the California Supreme Court, at the outset of its legal discussion, and then several times in the brief, cite Strickland. They quote the prongs. They state the test that they are doing. Strickland itself said that you must consider the totality of evidence before the judge or the jury. Now, that evidence comes in different ways. You can argue a penalty case phase case by referring to mitigating evidence of the circumstances of the crime, which is exactly what counsel did here. So you wouldn't ignore that. You do, as Strickland said, and as the California Supreme Court followed precisely, they said the test before us, and I'm quoting from page 25 of the supplemental excerpts of record, this is the California Supreme Court, the question before us is whether, had the mitigating evidence been presented at the reference hearing, been presented at trial, it is reasonably probable that the outcome would have been different. That's pure Strickland. So you don't ignore everything that counsel did. You look at the impact of the unprofessional errors and how the penalty phase would have proceeded absent the errors.
You compared Mr. Ross to his siblings. Do we know if any of his other siblings were born at least a month prematurely due to a violent attack on their mother by their father?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of the birth circumstances of any of the siblings.
So I guess I'm just trying to figure out, because we have to determine, not just whether or not it was reasonably possible that at least one juror would have been moved or swayed by the evidence of the 15 family members or however describing abuse that Mr. Ross suffered or was or was exposed to some of it, which was rather violent. I know it may not be perhaps the same abuse suffered by Mr. Andrews, but here there was 15 family members who were willing to come forward and testify, you know, about the serious abuse, which I think the state Supreme Court acknowledged was significant or substantial, I think is the word that they used. And we have to determine whether or not the Supreme Court's decision was unreasonable in saying that no, not at least one juror would have been swayed by it. And that's what I want your help with, helping me sort that through, because it seems that, can we say that at least not one juror, or that, you know, hearing everything that all these 15 family members would have very painfully and eloquently said. And I understand the aggravating nature, you have to take that into account. Especially in light of Avena, can you tell me how that factors in?
Absolutely. As a threshold matter, I would dispute the test. The test is not an at least one juror standard. I know that's comes from Wiggins v. Smith in dicta. That was a jurisdictional matter because under Maryland law, if one juror did not, if the jury was not unanimous about the verdict, a death sentence cannot be imposed. So that was Wiggins talking about Maryland, and it was repeated again in Andrews v. Texas.
What if one juror holds out on the death penalty in California?
Then it's a mistrial. It's different. Then there's a retrial of the penalty phase. It's not the Wiggins situation where it's one juror.
I think you're quibbling with words here, because he wouldn't have had the death penalty if one juror would have not gone along.
There would have been a mistrial, Your Honor.
Well, no, what you're saying, at that point, he wouldn't have, and then the state would decide whether or not to retry it, or whether to just enter into an agreement for life without parole or something like that.
That's correct. But I would point out that, as Strickland itself says, it's not a one juror standard. It's whether the decision actually reached by the state court would reasonably likely have been different absent the errors. So it's not under a pure Strickland test. I think that one juror question is misleading. It's whether the decision, the outcome, would have been reasonably probable to be different.
Seems like that's the decision in Wiggins and Williams and Avena in Andrews, and that's all our precedent. It sounds like you may have a different view of that, but I'm just trying to go based on our precedent, what's guiding us, and what's your best argument on that. And so if you can confront Avena for me, please, I'd appreciate it.
Well, you'll have to refresh my recollection about the Avena.
It was August of 2019. It was offered by Judge Thomas. And basically, it was an individual who went on a crime spree. It was pretty aggravated in terms of the crime, a shooting spree where he randomly targeted people driving by, attempted carjacking, eventually killed two people. Their counsel didn't interview family and didn't investigate background. And the family would have testified that he was a loving person. And in one incident where Avena threw a chair at his dad to protect his mom during domestic violence, there was also evidence there of his PCP, that he was on PCP and suffered hallucinations while on PCP. The counsel was deficient, and California Supreme Court determined otherwise, and our court found that California Supreme Court unreasonably found it was an EDPA review based on the unreasonable application of Strickland, and that California Supreme Court unreasonably found no prejudice. So if you're not familiar with Avena, that can be helpful, but
well, I will point out that there's none of that type of mitigating evidence in Ross's case. We've got, other than the family.
Well, sure, that's the reason I'm asking that. It's the same kind of mitigating evidence that's an issue here with respect to the family.
Okay, I misspoke about the family members. I was talking about evidence of hallucinations or drug use. There simply isn't that here. I would point out, Your Honor, that the California Supreme Court itself weighed all of these things in great detail. They acknowledged the strengths and weaknesses of the evidence on both sides. They acknowledged the statements that from Ross's own mother about how, you know, that he hates white people and that I've done all I can, and out of my six children, he's the worst. They wrestled with the strength and weaknesses of this very carefully. There were dissenting judges here. That means that fair-minded jurists could disagree about the outcome. And I do not dispute that different judges viewing this matter could have reached a different outcome or weighed the evidence differently. But clearly, given the overwhelming aggravating factors versus the missing mitigating evidence, which was essentially I was well-loved by family members and had some abuse from my stepfather.
Right, but counsel,
the ultimate conclusion was
the error here is the failure to investigate, not just uncover all of this readily available testimony from people in respectful positions, but there was no mental health evaluation. There was no medical evaluation. There was nothing. There's no looking at school records and finding the trauma points in his life. I mean, this lawyer, and it's the same lawyer as in Andrews. I mean, he did nothing. So when you say what was there that could have come up, I mean, a psychiatric evaluation that wasn't allowed in the record during the referee. I mean, that's the ineffective assistance. Okay. And I want to ask you, do you agree that counsel's performance was deficient?
No one is saying that this guy did a good job. Okay.
Do you agree that under Strickland, this counsel's performance was deficient as the district court found?
For the purposes of this case and this argument, yes, I would agree with that, because the California Supreme Court assumed that very thing for the purposes of this state court adjudication. So what I think about counsel's performance, or what this court thinks about counsel's performance.
Well, the district court held it was deficient. Are you arguing we should reverse that?
The district court here denied habeas relief because...
Right, because there was no prejudice after a finding that counsel's performance was deficient. Are you saying we should reverse that finding?
No, Your Honor, because even if this court believes that counsel's performance was deficient, this is a 2254 case, so relief is still barred unless this court finds that the Cal Supreme's prejudice prong analysis, because that's the only adjudication we have, is prong two, prejudice. AEDPA still would bar relief unless that prejudice prong analysis was, as Richter explained, so lacking in justification that there was an error in existing law beyond any possibility for fair-minded disagreement. So,
because I understand what your ultimate argument here is, the one we have to deal with, wrestle with. And so how can we know what would or would not have influenced the jurors in this case? I mean,
you don't any more than I do.
All right. So then let me ask you this. Is it not unreasonable to believe that not one juror might be moved by the evidence of Ross's very rather turbulent background and possibly character testimony from his family?
I suppose that's possible, Your Honor, and the California Supreme Court acknowledged that very possibility. But this is how the judicial review process was supposed to work and did work here.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Mercer, because I didn't ask whether it was possible. My question and what we have to deal with is not unreasonable. And to believe that at least one juror might be, I mean, that, and that, you know, the California Supreme Court here, majority determined that that was, you know, I guess determined otherwise. And I'm just trying to figure out, was that really reasonable?
You know, I don't dispute that that also would have been a reasonable outcome in this case. I don't dispute that.
Under the AEDPA standard, let's admit it, prejudice is squishy and people see it differently. And we have different experiences, judges, that we come to this in terms of what we think something would make a difference or not. But under the AEDPA standard, how many judges said it wouldn't have made a difference? So what the California Supreme Court was, what, 5-2?
That's correct.
And so then
the district court,
the referee said prejudice, but the California, then the district court said no prejudice. So we're at 6 people, I guess.
Well, I think this case is a perfect example about how fair-minded jurists could and did disagree about this case. And that is not the standard for relief. If that is true, if fair-minded jurists can disagree about the outcome of this case, then AEDPA bars relief. So yes, I think fair-minded jurists could and did indeed disagree about this case. I don't dispute that. But the question is there a theory that supports and justifies the majority opinion here? And obviously unanimity is not the yardstick for the reasonableness of an appellate opinion. Everybody, all of your honors have been on majority and dissenting in opinions. It doesn't mean that the majority opinion is objectively unreasonable. They might disagree with it, but it's not objectively unreasonable.
Can I ask you about the Edmund?
Yes, Your Honor.
So Ross cited Edmund versus Florida on direct appeal to the California Supreme Court. So, but you're arguing that it's procedurally defaulted. I'm not so sure I agree with you on that.
Okay. Well, the California Supreme Court expressly stated that it was procedurally barred when they denied the habeas corpus claim in 1999. They said it's, quote, procedurally barred on the ground that it was both untimely, citing Robbins, and, quote, because it could have been raised but was not raised on appeal, citing Dixon.
It was raised, but not under the name Edmund.
No, it was raised
as an argument that no specific intent was found, and because the jury wasn't asked in the aiding and abetting instruction to find a specific intent to kill on as to Ross, but they answered it. They didn't answer it under the rubric of Edmund. What do we do with that?
Well, my understanding is they answered it in the context within how it was raised, which was a state law claim about aiding and abetting instructions. There was some back and forth about, did the California Supreme Court or did the jury make an actual finding about his intent? And the California Supreme Court answered that question in the affirmative at Supplemental Excerpts of Records, page 112. The court said, quote, we have repeatedly held that a reasonable juror would construe this instruction, referring to the special circumstance instructions, as imposing a requirement of intent to kill. So there's no mystery about what intent the jury found. It was intent to kill.
Right. So I guess my question, I agree with you. That's exactly what the California Supreme Court did. But I guess my question is, okay, so that issue of whether there was specific intent to kill, which was not called Edmund, but it's the same issue as what Edmund requires. You at least recognize that, right?
Certainly. And
okay, so it's the same issue. So well, I don't see why it's procedurally defaulted, because I mean it seems like it was redundant. it was raised again only using the name Edmund at that point. Well, but it was already raised and answered by the Supreme Court.
You know, it's while these issues involve the same thing, they involve aiding and abetting liability. It was raised on direct appeal as an aiding and abetting claim and one of instructional error. It was a state law claim. They resolved that issue as a state law claim. It wasn't until the Edmund claim was raised in 1999 where Ross, in fact, alerted the court to his federal claim, Edmund and Tyson. It was at that point where the California Supreme Court expressly found the claim was procedurally barred. And this court and the U.S. Supreme Court has found that the untimeliness bar is a clear indication that, Robbins' site was a clear indication that they had imposed an untimeliness bar. And the Dixon bar of not raising an appeal, the U.S. Supreme Court in Johnson v. Lee said that was adequate. And this
if
court.
If we don't find it procedurally defaulted, can we find that Ross possessed the requisite intent to kill when it convicted him of the special circumstance murder given by the jury instruction on that charge?
Absolutely, Your Honor. If this court chooses to look at the merits of the claim fails because the jury found, made a finding, a factual finding about his intent, that he harbored intent to kill. This court in Tapia v. Roe acknowledged that such a finding by a California jury means that the omission of the aiding and abetting instructions was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt and that it didn't have an injurious effect on the verdict. And even more so.
Without Tapia, is the jury instruction problematic?
Well, it was problematic in that as the California Supreme Court noted, there were instructions that were omitted. So there was state law instructional error, but.
And then this instruction here, the intentionally is aided, abetted, counseled, or requested or assisted the actual killer. There's no, it doesn't come in front of the killing, you know. So seems like it's problematic without Tapia. And I'm trying to figure out Tapia is in a death case.
Whether it's problematic or not, I would submit that the California Supreme Court, number one, is the final arbiter of questions involving state law instructions. And number two, Tapia is a decision of this court and found it upheld what my argument.
No, I understand. And I'm just trying to figure out if Tapia is enough here in a death case, because Tapia was not a death case.
Well, even without Tapia, you have the Tyson test itself. And I think it's beyond serious debate whether Ross was a major participant in these crimes or acted with reckless indifference. He committed these crimes in concert with fellow gang members. He was present at both murder scenes. He raped one of the murder victims' sister twice. He made no effort to assist these dying victims. He failed to report the murders to the authorities. And then he and his cohorts from his gang did the same thing just days later at another home invasion robbery. So clearly he was a major participant and acted with reckless indifference. So no matter how this court goes, whether it's procedurally barred, whether it's harmless error because of the finding of intent, or whether this court applies the Tyson test, the relief is barred under any of those scenarios. Unless there are further questions, Your Honor, I would summarize by pointing out that no holding from the United States Supreme Court required that the California Supreme Court had to decide either of these claims in Ross's favor. And AEDPA, therefore, requires that state court adjudication of the claims must stand and the judgment of the district court should be affirmed. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you very much, counsel. I think Mr. Newton and Mr. James, you each have 5 minutes. Mr. James, you're on mute.
Sorry, Your Honor. Without beating a dead horse, we fully brief the issue of the contrary to that we claim. I would say this, the question was asked simply, and I think the right one, was it permissible for the California Supreme Court to include in its assessment of prejudice the argument and strategy of the deficiently performing attorney, because they did assume deficiency? Well, the answer is that there is no legal support for that at all. And in fact, there's support for the argument that that is not permissible, that it is contrary. I just wanted to say that the Supreme Court, if you look at their decision, 210 and 211 at the pages where they really get into the argument, and they actually specifically hold that the argument and the strategy of the attorney Lenoir must, quote, must be considered and would have justified not offering the mitigation. There is no support for that in the established law. The Supreme Court, as we cited, if you look at Sears specifically considered that. That was the issue there, was the adding the performance of the deficient counsel into the equation. They cited this balancing test, which is repeated throughout law. We consider the totality of the available mitigation evidence, both that adduced at trial and the evidence adduced in the habeas proceeding, and reweigh it against the evidence and aggravation. And in Sears, they say, in all circumstances, the proper prejudice standard for evaluating a claim of effective representation is that test. And if you look at, I won't get into it, it's in the brief, but if you look at their I think it's footnote 10 in Sears, this is exactly what they discussed, was considering the argument and strategy of counsel. And in that case, there was no question that there actually was a strategy and an argument. In this case, one cannot even argue that. So I think I would ask the court to carefully consider whether or not that's appropriate or proper. I think it's not. If you look at all the cases, right down through Andrus v. Texas, 2020, assessing whether the petitioner has made the showing, a reviewing court must consider totality of the available mitigation evidence, both that adduced at trial and evidence adduced in the habeas proceeding, and reweigh it against the evidence and aggravation. Argument is not evidence. The strategy of the counsel is not evidence. And once it's concluded that the strategy of the counsel was deficient, then that strategy and that argument is irrelevant, as the courts have said, including in Strickland. I wanted to quickly address the issue of the reasonableness, which I don't think applies, but nonetheless, looking at three major cases, certainly in Andrews, there was some evidence of mitigation in that case. And there was also some evidence in Viscotti. There was a strategy and evidence presented. It just was not with an adequate investigation to make that viable. In this case, it is just like the most recent one in 2019, Avena, in that there was no evidence of any kind of mitigation presented in this case. That's what sets it apart. That's what set it apart in the BDV. We look at them. There was no evidence. Here, there was no mitigation. And I agree, that doesn't automatically mean that it's unreasonable to find it to have no prejudice. But certainly, that's, as it's pointed out in the BDV, that's a very important fact. To say that there was a reasonable determination here of prejudice when there had been no effort and no mitigation presented is unreasonable, even though I don't think that's the standard. I think that takes 25 minutes. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you. Mr. Newton?
thank you, Your Honor. The Edmund issue came up well before February of 1999. In the opening brief on direct appeal, Edmund is cited at page 13 of the supplemental excerpt of record and also at pages 12, 16, and 17. In the closing brief, Ross pointed out in his closing brief that the Attorney General had not even addressed the Edmund argument. That's at page 42 of the supplemental excerpt. In the opening supplemental brief on direct appeal, Edmund was cited at page 57 and at page 57 in the supplemental brief. And in the closing supplemental brief, Edmund was again cited and Tyson at page 62 of the supplemental excerpt of record. The point being, counsel says this was a state court determination of state court law. Well, that's hard to reconcile with the fact that Edmund was decided 4 months before this trial started in 1982, and it was on the books and had been on the books for 15 years when, maybe it's 13 years, when the California Supreme Court issued its decision. And to get back to one comment raised by the court, the problem is, what does it take to kill somebody who aids and abets a felony murder? If he's assisting in the underlying felony, but there's no intent shown as defined by Edmund in his participation in the actual murder, it's not sufficient because death is treated differently. And the jury instruction 8.80, if you read it, it only says that if Ross was not the killer, but he aided the killer in the commission of a first degree murder, then that finding is supposed to somehow satisfy the rule at Edmund. It simply can't. And I think if you're...
What do we do with the fact that the California Supreme Court on direct appeal treated it as a state court instructional issue and did not explicitly refer to Edmund?
Well, I don't think you can give much weight to a state court which has a decision directly on point of felony murder and ignores Edmund, doesn't even address it, doesn't even discuss it. As I just pointed out, certainly counsel for Ross raised this on appeal, on direct appeal. I mean, it's Ross's attorney was saying to the California Supreme Court, your interpretation of felony murder is inconsistent with felony murder under the laws of the Supreme Court. And that's the reason that decision is completely contrary to Edmund.
All right. Does anyone have any further questions? All right. Thank you. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Ross versus Davis will be submitted and the session of the court is adjourned for today.
This court for this session stands adjourned.